Now, I suppose you have realized by now that these talks are not meant to only impart information. They are to some extent to try to inspire, and to some extent to try to inspire new thought on the part of everyone. So now comes the time when I start asking you questions. Mm-hmm. Like, I suppose every one of you figured out from last night that when you do one exercise, it makes you want to do the other exercises. For example, when we talked about doing the morning exercise and being completely still and not even opening your eyelids because that involves a muscular movement, that brings up a big question. Usually when you first awake, that's the time that you want to go to the body.
Right.
And that means it causes you to think about eating and drinking late at night. Because if you eat and drink late at night, it's a certainty that you're going to want to do that. So it helps you culture other parts of your other parts of your spiritual life. It helps you to think more about your personal habits of eating and drinking and things of that nature. Now, actually, we're not going to get very far again tonight. This is going to be sort of like a second introduction. Last night was the first introduction, and this is going to be the second introduction. And we'll begin by talking about the way. In the Gospel of St. John, there are 9 different I Ams that Christ uses. There are actually 10, but one is a duplication of the other. I'm not a Bible shark, but now with the internet, you can search out every word, and you can search St. John's Gospel, and you can find every I Am in a flash of a second. But one of the I Ams that Christ uses is, he says, I am the way. And therefore, if we want to understand our life in Christ, we can look at our life in the way. And for us, the way is the highway, or it is the street. And so our behavior on the street indicates, to some extent, our performance in Christ. I have a tendency to be self-righteous. And if I see people do outrageous things that are unfair to other drivers, like if there's merging traffic, and then these guys go way on the side and run way up, and then they try to merge in and they slow it down for everybody else, I tend to get outraged by that. And that outrage is a product of my self-righteousness. Let's suppose something simpler than that. Suppose we're going down the street, and it's pretty heavy traffic, and suddenly the car in front of us stops. We hit the brakes as hard as we can hit them, but we still run into the car in front of us. Then suppose another thing. Suppose we think we're going to save some money on gas, and we're driving along a country road, and we're coming down a big hill. We say, well, if I put the clutch in, I can save money on gas. Now, in both instances, if there is an officer present, the officer will arrest us or will give us a ticket. It will say that we are at fault. And the way that we are at fault is the same for both instances. Anytime you run into the back end of another vehicle, you're at fault because you did not have your car under control. If you are freewheeling, which is another name for coasting, you do not have your vehicle under control. And those are traffic laws. And traffic laws are safety laws, and usually they're all pretty good. But there is a message for us along the way, and that is that we have to have our vehicles in control. We have to have our consciousness in control. We know that if we say something unkind, we can hurt someone very deeply. We can set them back quite a bit. It isn't the only reason, but it is one of the primary reasons why the most basic Rosicrucian Fellowship exercises are concentrative. A person cannot progress, cannot unfold, cannot gain much from the consciousness unless one has self-control. And self-control comes from concentration. Now, if somebody says, I just can't concentrate, but I would like to meditate, from the viewpoint of the Rosicrucian philosophy, that is delusional kind of thinking. A person can't conceivably hope to advance himself with meditation without learning to have concentration. Even if one does have meditative states, a person can't benefit from them without the control that comes from concentration. So if someone says to you, I just can't concentrate, you don't have to say it in a judgmental way, but you can say to them, yes, you can. Because it's something that everybody is capable of doing. Even if we can't see the immediate progress. In St. Matthew's Gospel, we're told to pray believing that our prayers will be answered, and they're more likely to be effective that way. We're in pretty deep ignorance. We don't know who we really are, and we don't know really what we're capable of. Most people, if you say that you're a divine being, they doubt that. For now, and probably for the near future, faith is a large part of any kind of development and advancement. Faith in the divinity within. So it is a perfectly justified thing to say to someone, yes, you can. You can even say it to yourself. Now, with faith, it makes it easier. And with faith, the faith helps it to become a mounting experience so that it gets better and better all the time. And when we have a little bit of success, we want to work even harder. That's the way spiritual exercises are. If we are really in them right, it encourages us to do more and more and more. But even with faith and even with encouragement, what we're trying to do is not easy. It is not easy. Like if we think about concentration, where you want to be in control of every one of your thoughts, or you want to be able to call up a new thought that you've never had before, that's what thinking is, that's a very hard thing to do. If you think about it, picture trying to do this. Take your hands and dip them in oil so that your hands are just coated with oil. And then go to a stream and put your hands in the stream and try to catch an elusive little trout or a little fish that can dart this way and that. That's about how hard it is to be in control of every one of our thoughts. It's not an easy activity. It's preposterous to think that we can become divine spiritual beings without a lot of work. If it were just so easy, we would have as many saints as we have millionaires in the world. And there are quite a few millionaires these days. And saints are very, very few. It doesn't have to be hard labor. We don't have to set ourselves up for saying, oh, this is a hard thing to do, because that is that, you know, that's just putting ourselves in a hole to begin with so that we can't go forward. Work is enjoyable. Christ says that my joy may be full in you. And if we're trying to grow in the Spirit of Christ, that can be a perfectly joyous activity. It can even be a wonderful challenge. It doesn't have to be drudgery. We have the words from the biblical Christ, which is different than from the living Christ. We have the words, my yoke is easy and my burden is light. When we're not doing it personally and putting the ego focus on ourselves, it becomes that way. It's loving, caring work. If you have a baby, there's a lot of work. But tending for that baby is a very caring kind of work. It's a very loving kind of activity. It's a worthy work. It's worth doing. What else are we going to do with our lives? We're going to sit around and watch television and eat chocolates? A lot of people think that way. So once we begin to see that this is our destiny and that work is really a very healthy, happy kind of activity, it becomes very joyous. So it's easy to say, yes, you can. If I could do anything for you, I would like to give you the encouragement, if you're not already well developed in concentration or in self-control, I would just like to give you that kind of optimism that you can do it. Now, not all schools of spiritual philosophy teach the same methods that the Rosicrucian Fellowship does. We mentioned it several times last evening that all of the exercises given by the philosophy of the Rosicrucian Fellowship are based on cosmological principles. They are concentrations of the very principles that keep the universe moving along, that propel the divine plan. Now, there are some that try to proceed straight to meditative kind of consciousness without working with concentration. Now, we can do that. There are a lot of things that we can do because we are divine beings, whether they are the right things to do or not. We can take little children and we can force them to do very advanced things for their age, and they can do it. But it is not the best for them, and it's also not the most healthy for them psychologically. So this brings us to some important things about spiritual exercises and spiritual work. All exercises work. All spiritual exercises work. Now, because of the principle of cause and consequence, which is ubiquitous, it's everywhere, all at the same time, it has to be that way. Any kind of exercise has to work. But we have to remember that cause and consequence, the consequence is going to be exactly what we put into the cause. And there is a statement that's very important when selecting and doing spiritual exercises. And that is, what we do is what we become. What we do is what we become. So a lot of things will have effects. A few years ago, there was a spiritual teacher from India who was a wonderful teacher. His name was Krishnamurti. And he said a very wise thing. He said, if you say Coca-Cola enough times, you're bound to have a remarkable inward experience. And that is an example. What has happened in the Western world is that for several rebirths now, we have concentrated on our work in the material world. We're not so far advanced that we can do many things all at the same time, and the dense physical plane is only going to be here for a while, so we have concentrated on fulfilling that season. How did the farmer say it? You make hay when the sun shines. And the sun is shining on material experience, and to the ignorance or to the intentional ignoring of spiritual things, we have worked on material development. We've done marvelous things. We've done miraculous things with the material world. And in doing that, that is a kind of a specialization. We have ignored and we have forgotten a lot of the spiritual side of our development. But it can stay that way, and sometimes within us there comes to be a longing, and we long for the spiritual life. And what often happens is when a person is coming from several lives of materialism, they're basically virgin to spiritual activity. And they have no idea what it is all about. And so what happens is somebody will say, well, try this. And they'll try it having never tried anything else before. And they'll say, wow, it works. And they will follow a spiritual path just because the exercise worked. It's a great service for us to help people to realize that all exercises work, whether they are healthy or pro-evolutionary or not, for people to realize that whatever you try is going to work. But how do you want it to work? What do you want to become? And that's something that's very important for a person who's new to approaching the spiritual life. Now that simple fact opens us up to several other things. In repeat, what we do is what we become. And that leads to another Bible statement. By their fruits ye shall know them. The fruits that come of a person are a consequence of what they have done. So when we are looking for a spiritual philosophy, or if we're beginning with the spiritual philosophy, it's important to ask questions of it. We must ask of ourselves, what do we want to become? And most people don't have any idea of what they want to become. Some people have idea of becoming a flashing magician. Some people picture themselves as being sages. And other people picture themselves as being kind, warm, gentle people. And when you see people who have done spiritual exercises of one kind or another, you ask yourself, is this what I want to become like? Because by their fruits you shall know them. If we observe the product of practicing meditation without concentration, we may find someone who has lofty ideas, and who is very broad-minded, but perhaps is a little bit spaced out. And they don't have the sharpness, they don't have the acuteness or the astuteness of consciousness. So you can tell the difference, for example, of somebody who retrospects versus somebody who does not retrospect. There is more of that realization of the connection between cause and consequence, because it's watched every night in retrospection. This is why it is so important to study cosmology, to see where the universe is tending us, and what is the next thing for us to do, what's the next step on the path. And it's important to learn to intuit. Because through both of these things, through the study of cosmology and through intuition, our path has relevancy. We're working on something that is relevant to the cosmos. And we're not just off doing our own thing, and we're not off in it's easy to be captivated by cultural conditioning. A lot of people say, well, I follow this path because it's been around for a long time. If I've heard that once in life, I've heard it 20 or 30 times. Yeah, this has been around for a long time. I figure that's reason for me to do it. For me, that's reason to not do it. Because it's been around a long time, but over that long period of time, each of us has changed. And we can't do the kinds of exercises that we did several thousand years ago. So that, you know, we have to ask ourselves those kinds of questions and look at whether something is culturally relevant. All of us have gone through the study of science. And the study of science has a lot of doubt in it. And a lot of us, I was an atheist when I began this. And I doubted everything. And my doubts are now being answered. And that's an altogether different kind of consciousness than somebody who has never had any doubts. So we have to see the relevance of something to our lives and what we have passed through in evolution. Even if we have only a minimal grasp of cosmology, and even if we have only a small inkling of what the evolutionary intents are, those are criteria for making good judgments with regard to spiritual exercises. Now we have to correct for all of that, because some of the statements I've made have been rather extreme. It is a fact that the people in the Western world have already practiced a good deal of concentration, and they practice a good deal of concentration in their everyday lives, so that if somebody does go straight to meditation, it's not the same thing as if a person hasn't been practicing concentration. So there are many people who are very astute and are very concentrated, very perspicacious in their observations of reality, so that they are already in their lives doing spiritual exercises. It's also a fact that anyone who practices concentration and practices it in a progressive way automatically comes to meditation. If you focus on something and you penetrate and you bring your attention into a center of being and you pass through it, you automatically understand the relationship of that thing to everything else in the cosmos. So we don't have to be afraid and say, well, when am I going to be ready for meditation? That happens automatically if you're practicing concentration well enough. One more correction is necessary, and that is to the whole notion of extremism that is not balanced. There are people in the world that are superb concentrators, better at concentration by far than anyone in this room. There are people that can concentrate and they can visualize a plant in that concentration so clearly that everybody in the room could see it. But if you ask them, what do you know about the place of plants in the spiritual evolution, what is the service of the plant kingdom, they don't know a thing. They have the concentration that they can do that kind of activity, but they don't know much about God. Even in places where this kind of activity is practiced regularly, people are warned against this. That is non-progressive concentration. That is more like a fixation where you are fixated on the concentration and not the concentration as a means to get into reality, to delve into the truth of something much more deeply. Word concentration is from the same source as concentric. It means to bring one's attention to a common center. And when you do that, you bring your consciousness, or you focus your consciousness on one thing, and you unify your consciousness with that one thing. It is like concentrated acid. Concentrated acid is pure acid. There's nothing else. There's only that one thing there. It is purely one thing. Now, the negative connotation of this is that we must be careful about allowing our consciousness to become too diffuse. But the fact of the matter is, the better our focus is, the more we are in control of our consciousness. Now, if you've ever talked to people who try to practice concentration, they get beyond the statement of saying, I can't do that. What you often hear is, I can't think of everything at one time. And that's exactly what a lot of people try to do. They think about one thing, and they bounce to another, and they do not have that singular focus. They have an unfocused attention. This is something like people, like I used to be a glutton in life. And when I was eating breakfast, I would think about what I was going to be having for dinner or for supper. It's it's one of those things that the very thing that you would think that a person would be a gourmand, that they would love the food that they're eating, but you're thinking so much about the next meal, you're not living in the moment that you are in right now. Now, sometimes the concentration is critical. If an individual does not think about the here and now, when you're doing something that is very delicate and that requires great concentration, you're endangering yourself. Suppose you were disarming a bomb. You not only have to have good concentration and not let your mind stray or wander or be deflected to something else, you have to have a very delicate kind of sensitivity that goes with it. Some of the things that we do with inner spiritual work require every bit as much concentration, and they are even more subtle. The spiritual life is not more spectacular. There are more and more spectacular things that happen, but the spiritual life is really more subtle. And if we want to advance spiritually, we have to, in our consciousness, be more and more subtle. We have to be able to see through the material world into the ethers, which are very powerful relative to the kinetic forces here, but they are also much more delicate. So we're talking here about spiritual exercises that are useful. We're not just talking about vain exercises. We're not talking about just producing spiritual experiences. We are again back at cosmology. We are learning exercises so that we can be useful to the process of the ongoing work of the evolutionary creation. We want to fit in. If you have a little child and you want to win that child to your favor, if you have a match, you ask the child to blow the match out. And because the child has done something for you, there is a bond. And everything that we do, if we do it to serve the purpose of the evolutionary creation, we build that kind of bond with the whole of creation and if we have a good concentration, if we can focus on the here and now, that solves a lot of problems by itself alone. Just by looking at things, you can see the way things are, and you can deal with it. But it is the person who doesn't really look to see what's there that's in trouble. Even if you give the answer to what your good problem is, they still can't get it. Now, the adepts, those great spiritual beings that founded the Rosicrucian order, have learned and they have corroborated each other's spiritual vision, and they have learned that we are all divided beings. It's something we all know about ourselves. We have a split character, not dangerously split in most cases. We have our true spiritual self, that thing that is so wondrous that when we are working in and with it, we are astounded ourselves by what we do and what comes out of us. And then there is that pseudo-self, that lower ego, or that, I don't know how to say it, it's pseudo-self, I guess, is good enough, which is a reflection of the true self. The seers of the Rosicrucian order have found and they have cross-checked that this second self, this pseudo-self, was built into the desire body to take care of us, to protect us. Because once we went through the fall, we declared our divinity. When we took the creative power in our own hands, we were in effect saying that we are gods. And when we did that, the hierarchies that used to guide us had to have a hands-off policy. They still guide us with cultural influences and astrological influences, but they can't just lead us around by the nose. They respect our divinity. But something had to be there to help us because we were still relatively helpless at that time. And so this second self, this pseudo-ego, was brought along in order to act as a protection to us and to look out for us. But what happened is it has something like a selfhood of its own. It's not a real selfhood. And it realizes that we are not conscious in the desire world. And so it has set up shop for itself. And it controls a lot of our activities. A lot of our lives are not so altruistic as we would like to think. And it resists a lot of spiritual development. It especially resists the really strong spiritual exercises, like retrospection. There's tons of resistance to retrospection. It's so hard to do. But there is a mythology that is not a true mythology, but a lot of people believe in it. And it's exactly the kind of thing that the lower nature wants us to believe. I don't know if any of you have ever seen that movie, 2001 Space Odyssey. And in that movie, the computer, whose name is Hal, has intelligence superior to the humans that created it, and it takes over. And that's good propaganda for the lower nature, and because the lower nature is the usurper, and it would like to have you believe that it is superior, and you can't be superior to your creator. If we... You want me to close the door? I don't mind closing doors.
No, that's okay.
You Angelinos are spoiled.
Thank you so much. I need to stand. That's it. Okay. Thank you.
I'm putting you to sleep, huh?
No, not at all.
So, a lot of inability to do spiritual exercise is a result of psychological resistance. And the most common tools that the lower nature uses are various forms of distraction. Thus, if we start doing concentration, we have to overcome this psychological resistance. And this is very good, because we not only learn concentration, but we get the power of will to actually do the activity at the same time. See, we have to look at everything on the spiritual path as a positive. Even something that looks like it's a terrible detriment to us is a positive. I read the story of a man once that was visiting Tibet. He found this Buddhist who lived in a cave, and he had a club foot, and he couldn't get around. And all of the other Buddhist monks, when it got cold, would leave. And here he would be left behind, maybe a bag of barley or something like that. He would be left behind in this cave for the winter. And the man who was writing the book interviewed him and said, are you able to progress spiritually in spite of your handicap? And the Buddhist laughed at him and said, I am unfolding spiritually because of my handicap. Everything that is a negative or that appears to be a negative to our progress really can be helpful to it. But talking the way we're talking now, it's as if we have already accomplished. And it's a good thing not to count our chickens before they're hatched. So the inner adversary has all kinds of tools, and it knows all the weaknesses and all of the places that we're ignorant of in ourselves. It's aware of them, and it throws them up to us because it wants to maintain its supremacy. We'll say, well, maybe someday conditions will be better. That's wrong thinking. Someday never comes. How did Shakespeare say it? Tomorrow and tomorrow and tomorrow. If we are free beings, we can do what we want to do when we want to do it. That's what freedom means. Freedom means we have the capacity to do what we think is right to do, irrespective of whatever kinds of conditions would be restraining us. Now, the presence of distraction does not necessarily mean resistance. It's something we just have to expect, that there are going to be distractions. This is quite a complicated world that we live in. There are things going on all the time, and there's never going to be a time that there's nothing going on. And sometimes distractions or seeming distractions are not a sign of failure, they are a sign of success. Let's take an example, and it's an example that is very relevant to the moment. Suppose we were focusing on the motto of the Rosicrucian Fellowship. God is light. If we walk in the light, as God is in the light, we have fellowship one with another. And suppose we try to concentrate on that, and there, it would be just as it is now. There's traffic going by on the street. Now, before we started to concentrate, we didn't notice that traffic. But in the silence of concentration, it seems to be a distraction. But maybe it isn't a distraction. Maybe it's a sign of success. Because we are trying to expand our consciousness. And when we focus on one thing and we do a good job of it, we begin to understand the relationship of that one thing to everything else around it, which includes the traffic. So if we say, well, I'm going to go someplace where there are no automobiles, that's shirking. That's running away from a condition where you can develop moral muscle. And that's not recognizing success when you've had success, no matter how minimal that may be. Now, when we have something like that happen, we understand understand a point as a reference to something else. And we have then another opportunity, freedom. We can choose whether we want to focus on the thing we want to focus on or on one of the things that relates to it. If we absorb ourselves into the object of our attention, we can get right into the center of the being of it as it exists in ourselves. And that is the path from concentration to meditation. The deeper an individual goes into concentration, the more things one becomes aware of in relation to it, even its relation to things in other worlds. If we focus on an object so deeply that we can feel what other people feel about that object, that is literally what desire world clairvoyance is. We are seeing the desires of other people relative to a specific object. And that is, that's what we're setting out to do. It's not just a matter of seeing bright lights and colors, it is a matter of understanding what those bright lights and colors are expressions of. Now, when we do something like that, we have to realize what we're experiencing. This gives you a chance to learn a big word, and that word is heuristic. And heuristic means self-educational. All spiritual exercises, if they are good spiritual exercises, are heuristic. You learn in the process of doing them. The time when you are doing a spiritual exercise is a very holy time. And you must consider everything that happens in that time a very holy experience. And with that attitude, when you're looking for higher truth, you're going to find it. You're going to be taught. You're going to be God-taught. This is the best kind of knowledge that you can get. You're taught by what you're learning right within the experience. Things reveal themselves to you from within. And knowledge that comes from within is the exact definition of what intuition is. Intuition is teaching from within. This is the best kind of exercise or experience that you can have with regard to exercises. Let's go back up a little bit. When we have the knowledge of what we're focusing on and we hear the traffic, we have another opportunity for freedom. When we understand that our awareness of the traffic going by is heightened awareness from the concentration of what we were concentrating on, we then have to decide what we want to do. A lot of people would choose to block out the traffic noise, but that defeats the very activity that you're going into. You're trying to learn more. You're trying to understand the relationship of the whole. And if you start blocking things out, you're blocking out the truth. Instead, the idea is that one exercises freedom. You choose which things you want to focus on. That's a free person. You know, if you live in a blocked world and nothing can get in, that's not a very healthy world. You become like a hothouse plant. As long there is a principle that works, that as long as we depend on things outside of ourselves, a teacher, as long as we have to depend on coffee to keep us awake or to help us be more conversant with other people, and we take it from without, we do not develop it within ourselves. Self-reliance means that we find what we need as much as possible within ourselves. This doesn't mean that the without is bad or wrong or anything like that. It just means that we are responsible to and for ourselves, and that when we rely on ourselves, we have a just and healthy relationship with the rest of the cosmos. Now, if you read through the writings of Max Heinlein, you might be surprised. You would think that he would have a daily or a weekly meeting with the teacher. That's not the case at all. It was very rare that when he once got the original teaching and he once started the Rosicrucian Fellowship, he went to the temple service in the inner worlds, but he did not have special meetings about what to do. Very rare cases that was the case. So, again, the teacher wanted him to be self-reliant. The teacher wanted a Rosicrucian Fellowship that was made of self-reliant people that made their own organization. We already have the Rosicrucian Order that's made by the adepts. The Rosicrucian Fellowship doesn't have to be dominated by them as well. It's up to us to live in fellowship and harmony and love with each other and be something that is a fit organization to direct people to the teaching of the Rosicrucian Order. If we give ourselves to things, it draws wisdom out of us. And when it comes out of us, it's all right to check it. In fact, the Bible tells us to try all things. In fact, in the first edition of the Cosmic Conception, there is a statement from St. Paul that says, prove all things. The truth isn't going to be harmed by being tried or by being proved. However, if we have preconception, that can't stand the test of trial. Preconception is trying to add something to reality that isn't really there. We're part of the whole cosmos, and therefore we should be able to put ourselves in touch with the reality of something, and we don't have to preconceive. The more we preconceive, the more we block ourselves from knowledge. Now, all of these things take a lot of time, and they take a lot of care. Max Heindel tells us that most people who are clairvoyants or have unfolded higher powers, a lot of them say they're not so sure they would go through it all again because of all of the troubles and all of the work and everything that's involved in it. But we're hooked. We can't not do it anymore. We realize the truth, and this is what we want more than anything else. We're going to get to the bottom of it, even if it means our own death. What I'm trying to say in this whole talk is that when one gets to know oneself, this is what happens when we turn inward, one develops an inner life. Whether it is an inner life of seeking meaning, or whether it is an inner life of creative work, or whether it is an inner life that is a life of prayer and devotion, that becomes something that is valuable beyond estimation. Even to have cultured a little bit of an inner life, which is all I've ever done, I am so grateful for the opportunity to cultivate an inner life and to get to know myself and to have something inward that this just no bounds to my gratitude in that. So that's a second statement we can carry with us. The first one is, you can do it. And the second one is build an inner life. By building an inner life, you have a temple that is unlike any external temple. Concentration can be practiced on almost any level. It can be practiced on the physical plane, the chemical region of the physical world, practiced in the etheric region, it can be practiced in the desire world or in the world of concrete thought. Not in the realms of spirit, but in the practice of concentration, it is the general will of the threefold spirit that is applied to the concentration, and that act of concentration and the application of that will is what awakens the spirit. It is in doing that that the light of consciousness becomes brighter and brighter within a person. That's one of the reasons for it. It's not just to have a skill in one of the concrete realms, it is to be awake. And that kind of effort for it is an awakening thing. It's important that we are awake right here, right now. This is the place that we can become awake the best. This is the final proving ground. The objectivity that we learn here will allow us, when we awaken to the higher spiritual worlds, to awaken in a wonderfully objective way. So it's important for us to be awake right here and right now. When we do this, we try to do it in complete balance. We try to focus on all of our bodies. We all know those people who are very, very cool and rational and have no emotional feelings. On the other hand, there are people who are emotionally excitable and they have no rational sense of things. They have no logical control of their life. As human beings, we have to have balance. Balance in all of our beings. Max Heindel tells us that insanity is when we are out of balance in such a way that we have focused on one of the worlds so much that we have ruptured the connection between that and the adjacent world. We can't get through to the spirit, and the spirit can't get through to the physical personality. So we want to be balanced, which means that we want to be balanced introversively and extroversively. By introversively, we mean we want to practice concentration in such a way that we observe things in the world, and we follow those observations into our own consciousness, or we penetrate into the various spiritual worlds. This is food for the gods. That is, the experience that we give out is actually spiritualizing matter. It is taking experience from the material world, which is objectively true and finally true, because it is a big resistance or a big ignorance to the knowledge of the spirit. And it is bringing it back into the truth north. That is the introversive stream. We also want to be able to work in the other direction. We want to, from within, conceive something and then carry it all the way out into the world and bring it to final completion. This is, there's a large section in the Cosmic Conception that speaks about observation and things brought all the way back to the self-conscious recognition of the self, and then the self initiates the response that carries all the way back out into the external world. We're coming very close to as far as we're going to go tonight. I suppose you've all figured out by now that this whole talk has been an evasion from having to describe what different exercises are like. And now for the last three talks, I can't evade anymore, and I have to describe what the exercises are like, at least as far as I experience them or as far as I know them. So we have now completed a two-part introduction. And I have to end with a slavish kind of confession. I'm not really a good concentrator. I have made improvement beyond what I thought I was capable of. And it seems remarkable to me that I can see that I'm not a really good concentrator. That doesn't make any difference to me, except that it stimulates me to do more. What does make a difference to me is that I am a better concentrator than when I began. And I can see that the improvement is a result of my own efforts. And that's the very thing that we, as probationary students in the Rosicrucian Order, have to do. We have to judge ourselves, and we have to see whether we really have made progress or not, whether we're kidding ourselves, or whether it is a reality. There's nothing that you could bless somebody with better than to say, how do you get better? And to thinking about the betterment of other people. That's about as much as we have for tonight, and let's close with the Rosicrucian students.
So that we may serve thee better from day to day. Let the word of our mouths and the meditation of our hearts be acceptable in thy sight. O Lord, our strength and our being.
Questions? All right. Tomorrow night will be a very hard night for me, because we're going to talk about the exercises I have done more than any other exercise. We're going to talk about prayer. And it's always hard to talk about things that are sacred to you, because an individual always feels, I don't know how you say it, you always feel humiliated by how little you have done. But sometimes you have to talk about those things, because it will be that very sting of not having to do that good thing to be better in the future. Thursday evening we're going to talk about retrospection, and Friday evening we're going to come back to concentration, but Friday evening is talking about progressive exercises. And the endeavor is to show that all of the exercises that are given by the Rosicrucian Fellowship in cognitive conception, if practiced well, become very, very advanced exercises. We don't need to go out looking for all kinds of special exercises, because what we have been given, if we do them and if we use them well, are very advanced. So what's that to do next year?